You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The name IBM was once synonymous with advanced computing. As one of the world's largest companies, it defined information technology for much of the 20th century. And although IBM remains an enormous and important multinational corporation with grand technological ambitions, there are many signs it has lost its competitive edge. Journalist Robert X. Crinsley explores some of the problems with Big Blue in his new ebook called The Decline and Fall of IBM. We have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. I'm pleased to welcome Robert Crinsley to our show today. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard.
And I assume that your title is meant as a reference to Edward Gibbon's The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. How is IBM like the Roman Empire?
Well, in the case of IBM, the Praetorian Guard that took over the Roman Empire is very similar to current IBM management, which is essentially a mercenary group that has very little to do with the actual functions of the organization and a great deal to do with pomp, circumstance, and bureaucracy.
For 57 years, the company had just two CEOs, Thomas J. Watson and his son, Thomas J. Watson, Jr. Did they set the tone?
They did set the tone, and they set the tone not only in terms of the technology, but also in terms of corporate responsibility and the way the company was run. They were very advanced in terms of employee benefits and making it a good place to work, and that is all in recent years gone by the wayside. The old IBM is dead.
You compare the IBM of two decades ago to Switzerland and Kuwait.
Yes, because it was prosperous and a bit slow and willing to defend itself and sometimes to cheat to do so.
And at the height of its power in the mid-1980s, IBM had 17 layers of management. That would make decision-making rather difficult.
Well, it makes it hard to make a wrong decision, but it also makes it hard to make any decisions at all.
But you say it cheated.
Well, they would, of course. IBM in the old days was into heroic action. They bet the company at several points at new technological waves and tended to win. Sometimes it took two or three tries, but they had staying power and they tended to win. But since the PC, they really haven't been doing as well.
I can't imagine IBM doing something like Google with Google Glass or a driverless car.
Well, certainly not the driverless car, but they'll do some things. And I think an important issue here is the style of the things. For example, IBM won Jeopardy.
Yes, the Watson.
It cost $1 billion. $1 billion to win Jeopardy. And that converts, by the way, to nothing in terms of product.
Did they have a plan? Did they see that victory as helping some of their products do better?
I don't think product – well, there's lip service to that. But for the IBM today, the customer – IBM's customer today is Wall Street. And it played really well with Wall Street, where it made them look like advanced thinkers and ahead of the curve, even if they couldn't turn it then into a product. They're talking now about turning Watson into some sort of product, but it's not real.
Well, how would Watson apply to a home product, which is where the money is?
Well, not necessarily to a home product, but if you're seeking knowledge from a huge database, you could conceivably use Watson, except all Watson knows about are Jeopardy questions.
Yeah. Well, and we already have Google.
Yes, and that's the point. Google did a similar thing in a very commercial fashion as opposed to this stunt.
I recall when computers used to have an IBM logo in the front. Does IBM even make computers these days?
They do. They make large mainframe computers and mid-range computers, and they make lots of big computers, and they don't make much money selling them.
Well, mainframe computers like the old things?
They still exist. They're called Z series.
And where are they used?
They're used in the same big companies that had them 20, 30 years ago because IBM sells traditionally to enormous companies.
So that's what it's chosen to do, which differentiates it from the companies we normally think of when we think high tech these days, Google, Apple, or Samsung.
Well, it costs IBM an average of $600,000 to prepare a bid for a contract. So they're certainly not going to go after a contract that's worth less than $600,000. And so that means that they've eliminated small and medium-sized businesses completely from their customer base.
And why do they need to have such large contracts?
Because they always have. What the better question is, why do they need to spend $600,000 bidding where their competitors spend almost nothing? And that's because they've built a bureaucracy of bids. They have hierarchies and little emperors and empresses who just do bids.
Don't they make computer chips?
They do. They make processor chips. They're power series processors, and they go in a lot of things, but they're also negotiating to sell that business like they're negotiating to sell most of their businesses.
Now, it's interesting that they played such a major role in transforming technology in the past, and they must be aware of the fact that they had this great success. But you say that the company's been doomed since 2010. What happened in 2010? Did their philosophy change, or did they realize that they weren't going to change their philosophy?
In the last 8 years, IBM has spent $101 billion buying back its own stock. That's giving that money to shareholders, which is not a bad thing to do, except that's more money than they've made in the last 8 years. And on top of that, throw an average 2% dividend. So that's like $120 billion for a company that doesn't make that much money.
You say they're doomed. I remember when people said that Apple was doomed. Apple really was losing out in the big war with Microsoft. And Apple turned itself around.
And IBM can turn itself around, too. Ginni Rometty, the current CEO, could have a blinding realization that she's on a bad path and could follow my advice in the last chapter of my book and could save IBM. But I don't think she will, because there's a decided denial and lack of originality and initiative at the top levels of IBM.
So it's like what we saw with General Motors, where we had this entrenched management that just perpetuated itself.
Well, you know, it's that and more, because in this book I contrast Mary Barra, who's the current CEO of General Motors, and Ginni Rometty, another woman who is the CEO of IBM. Ginni Rometty is following a game plan set by her predecessor 5 years ago. Who would do that? How do you plan 5 years in a hand? Think of who does five-year plans. The Soviet Union.
Yeah, China.
And it didn't work for them, and it's not working here.
Well, I would have thought that when you bring in a woman as a CEO, even with the changed climate of employment these days, that it's because you want to have something new happen, as we saw at General Motors.
Well, in the case of IBM, its appearance, you want there to appear to be something new happening. And she makes a very good presentation.
We're living in an era of supervalued internet startups. Companies like Instagram and WhatsApp have been bought for billions of dollars. Is the culture inside these companies radically different from the culture inside IBM's offices?
Yes, absolutely different. Different from any culture that IBM has ever had. You know, IBM doesn't have the startup culture today, and it didn't have the startup culture 50 years ago either. And so, you know, it's a big lumbering giant that is used to using its mass to good effect, but it's run out of mass.
At one point in the book, you ask, what would Steve Jobs say about IBM? How do you think he would have assessed the problems there?
Well, I actually asked him. I was the 12th employee at Apple Computer, so I knew Steve for 34 years. And I asked him that question, and he made a very interesting point. He said, when big companies have conspicuous success like an IBM or a Xerox, they, when it comes time to do it again, they look back at what they did the first time, and they what they want to do is they want to replicate the process. They say, whatever we did the last time, that must be the way to do it, and they refine the process. But it turns out the process isn't the key. What's key is the content. And IBM is great at process but terrible at content.
But the same sort of thing happened at Apple. Apple got rid of Steve Jobs.
And brought him back.
And then brought him back yeah. because they wanted to duplicate the process.
No. No, because they had lost their way and they wanted to figure out how to do what they had done before. They needed a visionary and they didn't have one.
And Apple has been involved in all sorts of things that you can't imagine IBM getting involved with. For example, the way we listen to music.
Sure.
Is it just a matter of thinking outside the box?
You know, what it is a matter of asking the question why. Big companies ask what and how much. But they never ask why. And Apple, in this case, Steve wanted to carry all his music in his pocket. And that was the iPod, and that was iTunes. He had to build an ecosystem for it. IBM has never done anything like that. And most importantly, the people at the top of IBM don't use their own products, so they don't really know.
Didn't IBM develop one of the first smartphones, the Simon, in the early 1990s?
Yes, they did, and didn't see it as being very interesting. It came out of IBM research, and it worked, and it could have been the first and best smartphone, and they dropped it.
Why?
Because they didn't see the potential. You see, the problem is when you have a $100 billion company, you're always looking for new $10 billion businesses. And in 1993, smartphones didn't look like a $10 billion business.
Of course, it's been a lot more than that.
Of course, but it has to be a $10 billion business for IBM to care about it.
Hey, but you're right. The thought of making millions of consumer electronic smartphones is probably terrifying to IBM.
Well, they're not good at making little things, and they're certainly not good at dealing with small customers. So, yeah, they couldn't do it. They most likely couldn't do it without having to change their entire culture.
Did they have patents that have at least allowed them to make some money from Apple and Samsung?
A little bit. IBM has the largest patent portfolio in the world, but it's not especially powerful in the mobile area.
Now, what was that smartphone like? Obviously, it wouldn't have been like what we see today, but would it have been better than the first smartphones we saw?
Well, it was the first smartphone, so therefore it was better than the phones that existed.
It had a touchscreen, didn't it?
Well, it had a keyboard and a screen. I don't believe it had a touchscreen. Mm-hmm. So it was more like a BlackBerry.
Mm-hmm. Deirdre, a listener, says that she and her whole family worked at IBM. She says it's a company that's evolving. They make a lot of money from their business partners selling their software and hardware and are innovators of internet security.
Well, they sell a lot of stuff. They buy software companies and starve them to death and milk them for profits. And that's how they do that. Their software business is growing modestly, and they do make a lot of money from it. But as I say, they're giving away 15% of the company every year. You can only do that for a while.
So why do you think Deirdre thinks that? Is that what IBM tells its employees?
What happens is that when people think of IBM, they think of the IBM of the 60s and 70s. They don't think of the IBM of today.
Another listener, Corky in Brooklyn, wrote, "My sister was laid off from IBM about 3 years ago after working for them for about 20 years. She claimed the company was setting its sights on Africa and was planting offices there to pioneer the tech industry there."
IBM is, oh, sure, Africa is, I suppose, of modest importance to them, but mainly what they're doing is they're moving their work offshore to places that are cheaper, especially India. There are more than 100,000 IBM workers now in India. Interestingly enough, one of the major initiatives that IBM has in India right now is to get a majority of their Indian employees to be college graduates. Can you imagine an IBM employee in the United States who isn't a college graduate? I can't.
Is this book a bit of an act of revenge? Early on, you describe writing IBM executives when you were a kid with an idea for voice interface technology.
No, in the preface, I talk about doing that in 1961 and how nice they were and how they took me seriously at age 8.
But then they didn't do anything with that.
Well, of course they didn't. I was 8.
But the idea was a good idea.
It was a good idea, but I'm afraid my implementation was not yet ready for prime time.
My guess is Robert Crinsley. His book, The Decline and Fall of IBM, is available as an ebook. We have a link to it on our show page.
It's also a paperback.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So we can get it. Is IBM, is Amazon selling it? Or
yes.
You don't have one of the banned books on Amazon?
No.
We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Robert X. Crinsley, his book, The Decline and Fall of IBM. I said it was available as an ebook. It's also being published by whom? In paperback?
Well, you can order it through Amazon.
Oh, okay. Well, it's about the title pretty much explains what your topic is here. You note that from 1911 until 1993, the company didn't lay people off, but then it started outsourcing a large part of its workforce overseas.
Yeah, IBM got in serious trouble in the early 1990s, and Lou Gerstner came in as the CEO, the first outside CEO, and the first CEO paid tens of millions of dollars, and he saved the company. And in doing so, move them into services that are their biggest business today. But that's the business that they're offshoring, that they're trying to send to India and Argentina and Brazil and places like that where people work a lot cheaper.
And everybody was doing it at the time.
Everybody is doing it. Everybody is doing it. But
he was the first?
But IBM does it. IBM does it with a different style. What they do is they honestly believe that one IBM engineer can replace another, and eight IBM engineers can replace one and do it a lot quicker. But unfortunately, if they don't speak English very well and they perhaps are not as senior as the one they're replacing, it doesn't really work.
You note that IBM also brings in extra workers to this country for special projects, often from India. Why not just hire an American IT worker? Again, is it just a matter of the Indian worker will work cheaper?
The Indian worker will work cheaper. And
but then you have to bring them in. You have to pay other expenses.
Still cheaper. Still cheaper. You know, $1,300 a month compared to $7,800 a month, still cheaper.
You write that the company's hardware business has struggled the most recently. What's been the major problem there?
Well, they've had a lot of reliability problems on their contracts, and they have made a lot of customers angry. And so what used to happen is that a customer would have a problem, they would come up with a solution, they would implement it, they would make it happen, they would provide all this really expensive hardware to run it on, and it would be wonderful. But the way they've been running the company the last few years, they've been bidding whatever it takes to win the contract and then not performing to make the profit.
You write that IBM spends too much time gold-plating new products and services.
Sure. They have all these $1 billion initiatives, you know, to make $10 billion businesses. But some of them don't have $10 billion worth of potential. IBM in the cloud, cloud computing is a big deal for IBM now. This is spending $1.2 billion to move into cloud. It actually is an area where they have the most potential, but they're competing with Amazon. And Amazon, you know, knows where every penny is. And IBM doesn't even have an accounting system.
Well, can anyone just get into the cloud?
Yes, as a reseller, you could. In fact, you, Leonard, could be in the cloud by this afternoon if you wanted to be, as long as you've got enough space on your credit card.
Well, my mother used to say my head's in the cloud, so maybe that gave me a heads up.
Our mothers were always right.
You know, the company has gotten in the habit of buying back its own stock, as you mentioned earlier, with borrowed money. Is that a common business practice?
No, it's not a common business practice. Usually companies borrow, buy back their stock in order to reward customers, reward shareholders, and reduce the shareholder equity and thereby raise the price. And they often do it with excess cash, and IBM doesn't really have excess cash. So they go through this process because sales are declining, and yet they have a commitment to have earnings increase. And there are only two ways to do that.
Share prices are tied to management bonuses?
No, management bonuses are tied to share prices.
Yeah.
Are tied to earnings goals, exactly. And, you know, that's a big deal in this book. It turns out that there's a lot of talk about the idea that the only reason for a company to exist is to maximize shareholder value. If you go on CNBC or Fox Business, you'll hear someone say that during the day. Turns out that's just a theory. It's a theory that dates to only 1976. Two professors from the University of Rochester came up with this theory that has been used ever since to justify massively increasing executive compensation, saying, well, we're aligning the interests of the executives with those of the shareholders by paying them a lot of money. Therefore, this will improve the performance of the company. But in terms of return on equity, in terms of return on shareholder equity is today on average 25% of it, what it was in 1965 for public companies.
You'd figure somebody would look at the numbers and understand that something's going wrong here.
Well, it's a shell game, but it's not in their interest to point it out. It's also not in Wall Street's interest because they make money on the flow.
And you point out that executive pay at IBM is quite high. What about wages for lower management and regular workers?
It's submarket.
And they pay below.
They pay below market wages, and people work typically 60, 70 hours a week.
It used to be that you wanted to work at IBM all your life and then retire because retirement could be very comfortable.
Yeah, but that defined benefit retirement plan has been gone since 2007.
What about healthcare benefits?
They're diminished and dramatically diminished. And for that matter, even retiree healthcare has been diminished.
What about shareholder activism? Has that had any impact?
Not much. Not much. There's a certain amount of employee activism, but shareholder activism is tied to earnings per share. When they stumble and it becomes evident that the stumble is permanent, then the shareholders will revolt.
We hear a lot about the headquarters, the campuses at Google and Apple. How do the IBM headquarters compare?
Well, they're big and grand, but there's no free food.
And people are not throwing spitballs at each other?
No, they're not. No, the workforce is overworked, underpaid, and angry.
Could computing... is it possible for IBM to suddenly come up with the next big thing?
It's doubtful that they'll come up with the next big thing, but it's very possible that they could use their bulk and their and the creativity of the 400,000 people who continue to work there to become a major player in some big businesses.
Well, you mentioned the cloud computing.
They sure.
made a commitment to cloud computing. Why can't they do well there?
I think actually they might do well there because they bought a company called SoftLayer, which is a cloud company, and they seem to be leaving it alone as opposed to what they typically do, which is buy companies and gut them. And so if they continue to leave SoftLayer alone, they have a chance in the cloud. But the cloud is a business that your prices drop 50% every year, and IBM is not used to functioning in a 50% per year price drop market.
The company has also invested heavily in big data analytics. Big data is a term which is thrown around a lot these days. What kinds of services is IBM getting involved with there?
Well, now that's a very good question because IBM likes to use the word big data and they like to pre-sell big data products, but their big data products don't actually exist. There is there's a technology used in big data called Hadoop. And IBM has a couple Hadoop products. Hadoop is what's behind Google and Facebook and Yahoo, and it's really important in the modern internet. And IBM has a couple Hadoop products, but IBM does, and 430,000 people doesn't have a single Hadoop expert I could find.
What is Hadoop?
Hadoop is the way of distributing a computing task that would have gone on a mainframe across 100,000 little computers. It's the future of computing. And IBM, until very recently, didn't know what it was.
We've been hearing about this for years.
Of course, but they
didn't hear about it?
They're mainframe-centric. You know, they think, well, but, you know, General Electric buys our mainframes. And General Electric is certainly not going to go to something like that until, of course, the day comes when General Electric does exactly that.
My guest is Robert X. Crinsley. His book, The Decline and Fall of IBM. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One of the slides recently leaked by Edward Snowden is titled NSA Strategic Partnerships and lists IBM as one of over 80 global companies it maintains an alliance with to gain access to high-capacity international fiber optic cables, switches, and or routers throughout the world. That was a quote. Is the infrastructure at IBM the most valuable thing it has?
No, I don't think so. IBM sold its network infrastructure to AT&T a number of years ago, which in itself was a bad move because AT&T is a phone company.
Does that mean it has broken its ties with the NSA?
No, that means that if the NSA wants, this is my understanding, is if the NSA wants data from IBM, they can get it. But most likely, a number of companies are involved, and IBM is just allowing it to happen.
Back in March of this year, IBM said it didn't share client data with the NSA for surveillance programs that involved bulk collection or metadata. Should we believe them or any tech company for that matter?
In this instance, I think I might believe them because I'm not sure were I running the NSA, I would be asking IBM. They're not involved in those communication businesses that the NSA is especially interested in.
We've heard a lot about how some of the other companies have been avoiding paying taxes in the United States, Apple especially. Does IBM do any of those things since they're so involved with bringing workers in and also offshoring so much of the work?
IBM is very sophisticated in both its legal and financial strategies. They have the largest legal department of any corporation in the world. And they have managed over the last few years to drive down their corporate tax rate from 27% to under 15%. So they're doing something right, I guess, depends upon who you are.
I'm amused by remembering that I just recently saw a show that's on cable now that is about the computer business in the 1980s. Somebody actually does a knockoff of an IBM computer in Texas, and the first show ends with IBM people coming in with all their lawyers.
Yeah.
But IBM is depicted in that as the giant, the monolith in the business. I was wondering why IBM didn't sue, and I realized that it has too many problems to deal with without having to worry about a cable show.
Well, I saw that show, and it's on A&E, and it's on AMC. That's right.
It's their attempt at doing Mad Men and computers.
Only it's compact computer.
Work.
You know, so it's an interesting show, but the way they present IBM as a technical leader is wrong. And the guy that they have leading the company who came from IBM, there actually was an IBM salesperson who was one of the co-founders of Compaq Computer. His name was Sparky Sparks.
What a name.
Yeah, what a great name. And Sparky Sparks just wasn't that impressive. So, they play him tall and sexy, and Sparky was short.
Has all the things we've been talking about hurt IBM's ability to sell products overseas in places like China?
Well, IBM has been hurt in China recently for a bunch of reasons, and that is one of the reasons for their lower financial performance in the last couple of years. And so, yes, when it came time to, when the NSA was hacking Chinese computers, they were probably IBM computers that they were hacking.
China's been pressuring banks to stop using high-end IBM servers, and that came after the U.S. government charged 5 Chinese military officers with hacking. Is IBM going to be on the front lines of cyber war for a while?
Well, as long as there are IBM installations, yeah, sure.
What do you think is needed to fix IBM? Do you see anything positive there?
Well, I see SoftLayer as being a positive move in the cloud area. Everything else is pretty much negative. But what they could do is they could stop with the stunts. They could take the billions of dollars that they're putting into stunts and pipe dreams and use them to rebuild their existing businesses and make a lot more money from them. $200 million rolled into the mainframe business could revolutionize it, but they won't do it. Because at IBM, the mainframe business is a cash cow, and they don't believe in feeding cash cows. They just milk them until they're dry.
And that's why you're saying they are now facing real problems. We saw the same thing at Xerox. Is this a problem that many corporations have when they become really big and think they're going to be there forever?
It's very difficult to invent the future more than once. And very few companies do it. You know, if you look at the Dow 30 Industrials, there's only one company from the original Dow 12 that is still there, and that's General Electric. Everyone else is gone.
And General Motors no longer says what's good for General Motors is good for America. What they say instead is we should have fixed that thing.
That's right. And to their credit, they've got a CEO who says she's going to do it. So that's good.
But there were even people predicting that General Motors would go under or Chrysler would go under when the crunch came a few years back.
But they did.
The government bailed them out. I don't see
the
U.S. government bailing out IBM.
They didn't bail out the shareholders. You know, everyone who owns GM stock got nothing.
But now they're reaping the rewards, aren't they?
They are, but they've been completely recapitalized.
I guess the final question is, in 20 years, will IBM be around? Will it be big?
I think IBM will still exist because there'll still be IBM mainframes that need maintaining. But
so they'll be repairing their own products.
The question is, will IBM be relevant? You know, what we won't hear, the question that won't be asked is IBM too big to fail? Because it's not.
Well, Kodak went under.
Yes, it's true.
And they were the giant in the film business.
But yes, they were. But film went out of business, too. You know, now movies are made with digital. And so that's the thing. The new wave came, and Kodak milked the last one as far as they could and waited too long, even though they invented the digital camera.
Robert Crinsley has written the Notes from the Field column in InfoWorld, a weekly computer trade newspaper. He's also the author of the book Accidental Empires, How the Boys of Silicon Valley Make Their Millions, Battle Foreign Competition, and Still Can't Get a Date. His latest e-book and also paperback is called The Decline and Fall of IBM, and his blog can be found at crinsley.com. Have I included everything?
You did it.
Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you, Leonard.